5. I was complaining to the bartender about the air conditioning. It was turned too high and we were all going to catch cold. No matter, he assured me. You won't feel it when you're asleep. Sleep, sleep, soup of the evening, beautiful sleep. He had Belle's face. How about a warm drink then, I wanted to know. A Tom and Jerry or a hot buttered bum? You're a bum, the doctor answered. Sleeping's too good for him. Throw the bum out. I tried to hook my feet around the brass rail to stop them, but this bar had no brass rail, which seemed funny, and I was flat on my back, which seemed funnier still, unless they had installed bedside service for people with no feet. I didn't have feet, so how could I hook them under a brass rail? No hands, either. Look, Ma, no hands! Pete sat on my chest and wailed. I was back in basic training. Advanced basic it must have been, for I was at Camp Hale, at one of those silly exercises where they throw snow down your neck to make a man of you. I was having to climb the damnedest biggest mountain in all Colorado, and it was all ice, and I had no feet. Nevertheless, I was carrying the biggest pack anybody ever saw. I remembered that they were trying to find out if GIs could be used instead of pack mules, and I had been picked because I was expendable. I wouldn't have made it at all if little Ricky hadn't got behind me and pushed. The top sergeant turned, and he had a face just like Bell's, and he was livid with rage. Come on, you! I can't afford to wait for you! I don't care whether you make it or not, but you can't sleep until you get there! My no feet wouldn't take me any farther, and I fell down in the snow, and it was icy warm, and I did fall asleep while little Ricky wailed and begged me not to. But I had to sleep. I woke up in bed with Belle. She was shaking me and saying, Wake up, Dan. I can't wait 30 years for you. A girl has to think of her future. I tried to get up and hand her the bags of gold I had under the bed, but she was gone. And anyhow, a hired girl with her face had picked all the gold up and put it in its tray on top and scurried out of the room. I tried to run after it, but I had no feet. No body at all, I discovered. I ain't got nobody, and nobody cares for me. The world consisted of top sergeants and work, so what difference did it make where you worked or how? I let them put the harness back on me, and I went back to climbing that icy mountain. It was all white and beautifully rounded, and if I could just climb to the rosy tip, they would let me sleep, which was what I needed. But I never made it. No hands, no feet, no nothing. There was a forest fire on the mountain. The snow did not melt, but I could feel the heat in waves beating against me while I kept on struggling. The top sergeant was leaning over me and saying, Wake up! Wake up! Wake up! He no more than got me awake before he wanted me to sleep again. I'm vague about what happened then for a while. Part of the time I was on a table which vibrated under me, and there were lights and snaky-looking equipment and lots of people. But when I was fully awake, I was in a hospital bed, and I felt all right except for that listless, half-floating feeling you have after a Turkish bath. I had hands and feet again. But nobody would talk to me, and every time I tried to ask a question, a nurse would pop something into my mouth. I was massaged quite a lot. Then one morning I felt fine and got out of bed as soon as I woke up. I felt a little dizzy, but that was all. I knew who I was, I knew how I had got there, and I knew that all that other stuff had been dreams. I knew who had put me there. If Belle had given me orders while I was drugged to forget her shenanigans, either the orders had not taken or 30 years of cold sleep had washed out the hypnotic effect. I was blurry about some details, but I knew how they had shanghaied me. I wasn't especially angry about it. True, it had happened just yesterday, since yesterday is the day just one sleep behind you, but the sleep had been 30 years long. The feeling cannot be precisely defined, since it is entirely subjective, but while my memory was sharp for the events of yesterday, nevertheless, my feelings about those events were to things far away. You have seen double images in television of a pitcher making his windup, while his picture sits as a ghost on top of a long shot of the whole baseball diamond? Something like that. My conscious recollection was a close-up. My emotional reaction was to something long ago and far away. I fully intended to look up Bell and Miles and chop them into cat meat, but there was no hurry. Next year would do. Right now, I was eager to have a look at the year 2000. But speaking of cat meat, where was Pete? He ought to be around somewhere, unless the poor little beggar hadn't lived through the sleep. Then, and not until then, did I remember that my careful plans to bring Pete along had been wrecked. I took Bell and Miles out of the hold basket and moved them over to urgent. Try to kill my cat, would they? They had done worse than kill Pete. They had turned him out to go wild, to wear out his days wandering back alleys in search of scraps, while his ribs grew thin and his sweet pixie nature warped into distrust of all two-legged beasts. They had let him die, for he was surely dead by now. Let him die thinking that I had deserted him. For this they would pay, if they were still alive. Oh, how I hoped they were still alive. Unspeakable! I found that I was standing by the foot of my bed, grasping the rail to steady myself, and dressed only in pajamas. I looked around for some way to call someone. Hospital rooms had not changed much. There was no window, and I could not see where the light came from. The bed was high and narrow, as hospital beds had always been in my recollection, but it showed signs of having been engineered into something more than a place to sleep. Among other things, it seemed to have some sort of plumbing under it, which I suspected was a mechanized bedpan, and the side table was part of the bed structure itself. But while I ordinarily would have been intensely interested in such gadgetry, right now, I simply wanted to find the pear-shaped switch which summons the nurse. I wanted my clothes. It was missing, but I found what it had been transformed into, a pressure switch on the side of the table that was not quite a table. My hand struck it in trying to find it, and a transparency opposite where my head would have been had I been in bed shone out with "Service Call." Almost immediately it blinked out and was replaced with "One moment, please." Very quickly the door silently rolled aside and a nurse came in. Nurses had not changed much. This one was reasonably cute, had the familiar firm manners of a drill sergeant, wore a perky little white hat perched on short orchid-color hair, and was dressed in a white uniform. It was strangely cut and covered her here and uncovered her there in a fashion different from 1970. But women's clothes, even work uniforms, were always doing that. She would still have been a nurse in any year, just by her unmistakable manner. "You get back in that bed." "Where are my clothes?" "Get back in that bed, now." I answered reasonably, "Look, nurse, I'm a free citizen, over 21 and not a criminal. I don't have to get back into that bed, and I'm not going to. Now, are you going to show me where my clothes are, or shall I go out the way I am and start looking?" She looked at me, then turned suddenly and went out. The door ducked out of her way. But it would not duck out of my way. I was still trying to study out the gimmick, being fairly sure that if one engineer could dream it up, another could figure it out, when it opened again and a man came in.
"Good morning," he said. "I'm Dr. Albrecht."
His clothes looked like a cross between a Harlem Sunday and a picnic to me, but his brisk manner and his tired eyes were convincingly professional. I believed him. "Good morning, doctor. I'd like to have my clothes." He stepped just far enough inside to let the door slide into place behind him, then reached inside his clothes and pulled out a pack of cigarettes. He got one out, waved it briskly in the air, placed it in his mouth, and puffed on it. It was lighted. He offered me the pack.
"Have one?"
No, thanks."
"Go ahead. It won't hurt you."
I shook my head. I had always worked with a cigarette smoldering beside me. The progress of a job could be judged by the overflowing ashtrays and the burns on the drafting board. Now I felt a little faint at the sight of smoke, and wondered if I had dropped the nicotine habit somewhere in the slept-away years. Thanks, just the same.
Okay. Mr. Davis, I've been here 6 years. I'm a specialist in hypnology, resuscitation, and like subjects. Here and elsewhere, I've helped 8,073 patients make the comeback from hypothermia to normal life. You're number 8,074. I've seen them do all sorts of odd things when they came out. Odd to laymen, not to me. Some of them want to go right back to sleep again and scream at me when I try to keep them awake. Some of them do go back to sleep and we have to ship them off to another sort of institution. Some of them start weeping endlessly when they realize that it is a one-way ticket and it's too late to go home to whatever year they started from. And some of them, like you, demand their clothes and want to run out into the street.
Well, why not? Am I a prisoner?
No. You can have your clothes. I imagine you'll find them out of style, but that is your problem. However, while I send for them, would you mind telling me what it is that is so terribly urgent that you must attend to it right this minute after it has waited 30 years? That's how long you've been at sub-temperature, 30 years. Is it really urgent? Or would later today do as well? Or even tomorrow? I started to blurt out that it damn well was urgent, then stopped and looked sheepish.
Maybe not that urgent.
Then, as a favor to me, will you get back into bed, let me check you over, have your breakfast, and perhaps talk with me before you go galloping off in all directions? I might even be able to tell you which way to gallop.
Okay, doctor. Sorry to have caused trouble.
I climbed into bed. It felt good. I was suddenly tired and shaky.
No trouble.
You should see some that we get. We have to pull them down off the ceiling.
He straightened the covers around my shoulders, then leaned over the table built into the bed.
Dr. Albrecht in 17, send a room orderly with breakfast. Menu 4-.
He turned to me and said, "Roll over and pull up your jacket. I want to get at your ribs. While I'm checking you, you can ask questions, if you want to."
I tried to think while he prodded my ribs. I suppose it was a stethoscope he used, although it looked like a miniaturized hearing aid. But they had not improved one thing about it. The pickup he pushed against me was as cold and hard as ever.
What do you ask after 30 years? Have they reached the stars yet? Who's cooking up the war to end war this time? Do babies come out of test tubes?
Doc, do they still have popcorn machines in the lobbies of movie theaters?
They did the last time I looked. I don't get much time for such things. By the way, the word is grabby now, not movie.
So? Why?
Try one. You'll find out. But be sure to fasten your seatbelt. They know the whole theater on some shots.
See here, Mr. Davis, we're faced with the same problem every day, and we've got it down to routine. We've got adjustment vocabularies for each entrance year, and historical and cultural summaries. It's quite necessary, for malorientation can be extreme, no matter how much we lackweight the shock.
I suppose so.
Decidedly. Especially in an extreme lapse like yours. 30 years.
Is 30 years the maximum?
Yes and no. 35 years is the very longest we've had experience with, since the first commercial client was placed in sub-temperature in December 1965. You are the longest sleeper I have revived. But we have clients in here now with contract times up to a century and a half. They should never have accepted you for as long as 30 years. They didn't know enough then. They were taking a great chance with your life. You were lucky.
Really?
Really. Turn over. He went on examining me and added, "But with what we've learned now, I'd be willing to prepare a man for a 1,000-year jump if there were any way to finance it. Hold him at the temperature you were at for a year just to check, then crash him to -200 in a millisecond. He'd live,
I think.
Let's try your reflexes."
That crash business didn't sound good to me. Dr. Albrecht went on. Sit up and cross your knees. You won't find the language problem difficult. Of course, I've been careful to talk in 1970 vocabulary. I rather pride myself on being able to talk selectively in the entrance speech of any of my patients. I've made a hypno study of it. But you'll be speaking contemporary idiom perfectly in a week. It's really just added vocabulary. I thought of telling him that at least four times he had used words not used in 1970, or at least not that way, but I decided it wouldn't be polite. That's all for now, he said presently. By the way, Mrs. Schultz has been trying to reach you. Huh? Don't you know her? She insisted that she was an old friend of yours. Schultz, I repeated. I suppose I've known several Mrs. Schultzes at one time or another, but the only one I can place was my fourth-grade teacher. But she'd be dead by now. Maybe she took the sleep. Well, you can accept the message when you feel like it. I'm going to sign a release on you. But if you're smart, you'll stay in here for a few days and soak up reorientation. I'll look in on you later. So, 23 skidoo, as they used to say in your day. Here comes the orderly with your breakfast. I decided that he was a better doctor than a linguist, but I stopped thinking about it when I saw the orderly. It rolled in, carefully avoiding Dr. Albrecht, who walked straight out, paying no attention to it and making no effort himself to avoid it. It came over, adjusted the built-in bed table, swung it over me, opened it, and arranged my breakfast on it. Shall I pour your coffee? Yes, please. I did not really want it poured, as I would rather have it stay hot until I finished everything else, but I wanted to see it poured. For I was in a delighted daze. It was Flexible Frank. Not the jack-leg, breadboarded, jury-rigged first model Miles and Bell had stolen from me, of course not. This one resembled the first Frank the way a turbo speedster resembles the first horseless carriage. But a man knows his own work. I had set the basic pattern, and this was the necessary evolution. Frank's great-grandson. Improved, slicked up, made more efficient, but the same bloodline. Will that be all? Wait a minute. Apparently I had said the wrong thing, for the automaton reached inside itself and pulled out a stiff plastic sheet and handed it to me. The sheet remained fastened to him by a slim steel chain. I looked at it and found printed on it, Voice Code, Eager Beaver Model 17A. Important Notice. This service automaton does not understand human speech. It has no understanding at all, being merely a machine. But for your convenience, it has been designed to respond to a list of spoken orders. It will ignore anything else said in its presence. Or, if any phrase triggers it incompletely or such that a circuit dilemma is created, it will offer this instruction sheet. Please read it carefully. Thank you. Aladdin Auto Engineering Corporation, manufacturers of Eager Beaver, Willy Waugh, Drafting Dan, Builder Bill, Green Thumb, and Nanny. Custom designers and consultants in automation problems. At your service. The motto appeared on their trademark, showing Aladdin rubbing his lamp and a genie appearing. Below this was a long list of simple orders. Stop. Go. Yes. No. Slower. Faster. Come here. Fetch a nurse. Etc. Then there was a shorter list of tasks common in hospitals, such as back rubs, and including some that I had never heard of. The list closed abruptly with the statement, Routines 87 through 242 may be ordered only by hospital staff members, and the order phrases are therefore not listed here. I had not voice-coded the first Flexible Frank. You had to punch buttons on his control board. It was not because I had not thought of it, but because the analyzer and telephone exchange for the purpose would have weighed and bulked and cost more than all the rest of Frank Sr. net. I decided that I would have to learn some new wrinkles in miniaturization and simplification before I would be ready to practice engineering here. But I was anxious to get started on it, as I could see from Eager Beaver that it was going to be more fun than ever. Lots of new possibilities. Engineering is the art of the practical and depends more on the total state of the art than it does on the individual engineer. When railroading time comes, you can railroad, but not before. Look at poor Professor Langley breaking his heart on a flying machine that should have flown. He had put the necessary genius in it, but he was just a few years too early to enjoy the benefit of collateral art he needed and did not have. Or take the great Leonardo da Vinci, so far out of his time that his most brilliant concepts were utterly unbuildable. I was going to have fun here. I mean, now. I handed back the instruction card, then got out of bed and looked for the data plate. I had halfway expected to see Hired Girl Inc. at the bottom of the notice, and I wondered if Aladdin was a daughter corporation of the Mannix Group. The data plate did not tell me much other than model, serial number, factory, and such, but it did list the patents, about 40 of them, and the earliest, I was very interested to see, was in 1970, almost certainly based on my original model and drawings. I found a pencil and memo pad on the table and jotted down the number of that first patent, but my interest was purely intellectual. Even if it had been stolen from me, I was sure it had been, it had expired in 1987 unless they had changed the patent laws, and only those granted later than 1983 would still be valid. But I wanted to know. A light glowed on the automaton, and he announced, "I am being called. May I leave?" "Huh? Sure, run along." It started to reach for the phrase list. I hastily said, "Go."
"Thank you. Goodbye."
It detoured around me. "Thank you."
"You are welcome."
Whoever had dictated the gadget's sound responses had a very pleasant baritone voice. I got back into bed and ate the breakfast I had let get cold, only it turned out not to be cold. Breakfast 4-minus was about enough for a medium-sized bird, but I found that it was enough, even though I had been very hungry. I suppose my stomach had shrunk. It wasn't until I had finished that I remembered that this was the first food I had eaten in a generation. I noticed it then because they had included a menu. What I had taken for bacon was listed as grilled yeast strips, country style. But in spite of a 30-year fast, my mind was not on food. They had sent a newspaper in with breakfast, the Great Los Angeles Times, for Wednesday, 13 December 2000. Newspapers had not changed much, not in format. This one was tabloid size, the paper was glazed instead of rough pulp, and the illustrations were either full color or black and white stereo. I couldn't puzzle out the gimmick on that last. There had been stereo pictures you could look at without a viewer since I was a small child. As a kid, I had been fascinated by ones used to advertise frozen foods in the 50s. But those had required fairly thick transparent plastic for a grid of tiny prisms. These were simply on thin paper. Yet they had depth. I gave it up and looked at the rest of the paper. Eager Beaver had arranged it on a reading rack, and for a while it seemed as if the front page was all I was going to read, for I could not find out how to open the darn thing. The sheets seemed to have frozen solid. Finally, I accidentally touched the lower right-hand corner of the first sheet. It curled up and out of the way, some surface charge phenomenon triggered at that point. The other pages got neatly out of the way in succession whenever I touched that spot. At least half of the paper was so familiar as to make me homesick. Your horoscope today, mayor dedicates new reservoir, security restrictions undermining freedom of press, says N.Y. Solon, giants take doubleheader, unseasonable warmth perils winter sports, Pakistan warns India, etc. ad tedium. This is where I came in. Some of the other items were new but explained themselves. Luna shuttle still suspended for Geminids. 24-hour station suffers 2 punctures, no casualties. 4 whites lynched in Cape Town. UN action demanded. Host mothers organize for higher fees. Demand amateurs be outlawed. Mississippi planter indicted under anti-zombie law. His defense? Them boys ain't drugged, they're just stupid. I was fairly sure that I knew what that last one meant. From experience. But some of the news items missed me completely. the Woglies were still spreading, and three more French towns had been evacuated. The king was considering ordering the area dusted. King? Oh well, French politics might turn up anything. But what was this poudre sanitaire they were considering using on the Woglies, whatever they were? Radioactive, maybe? I hoped they picked a dead calm day, preferably the 30th of February. I had had a radiation overdose myself once, through a mistake by a damn fool whack technician at Sandia. I had not reached the point of no return vomiting stage, but I don't recommend a diet of curries. The Laguna Beach Division of the Los Angeles Police had been equipped with lay coils, and the division chief warned all teddies to get out of town. My men have orders to narc first and subspec afterward. This has got to stop. I made a mental note to keep clear of Laguna Beach until I found out what the score was. I wasn't sure I wanted to be subspect or suspected, even afterward. Those are just samples. There were any number of news stories that started out trippingly, then foundered in what was, to me, double talk. I started to breeze on past the vital statistics when my eye caught some new subheads. There were the old familiar ones of births, deaths, marriages, and divorces, but now there were commitments and withdrawals as well, listed by sanctuaries. I looked up Sautel Cons Sank and found my own name. It gave me a warm feeling of belonging. But the most intensely interesting things in the paper were the ads. One of the personal stuck in my mind. Attractive, still young widow with yen to travel wishes to meet mature man similarly inclined. Object, 2-year marriage contract. But it was the display advertising that got me. Hired girl and her sisters and her cousins and her aunts were all over the place, and they were still using the trademark, a husky girl with a broom, that I had designed originally for our letterhead. I felt a twinge of regret that I had been in such a jumping hurry to get rid of my stock in Hired Girl Inc. It looked as if it was worth more than all the rest of my portfolio. No, that was wrong. If I had kept it with me at the time, that pair of thieves would have lifted it and faked an assignment to themselves. As it was, Ricky had gotten it. And if it had made Ricky rich, well, it couldn't happen to a nicer person. I made a note to track down Ricky first thing, top priority. She was all that was left to me of the world I had known, and she loomed very large in my mind. Dear little Ricky. If she had been 10 years older, I would never have looked at Belle, and wouldn't have got my fingers burned. Let's see, how old would she be now? 40. No, 41. It was hard to think of Ricky as 41. Still, that wouldn't be old in a woman these days, or even those days. From 40 feet, you frequently couldn't tell 41 from 18. If she was rich, I'd let her buy me a drink, and we would drink to Pete's dear departed funny little soul. And if something had slipped, and she was poor in spite of the stock I had assigned her, then, by damn, I'd marry her. Yes, I would. It didn't matter that she was 10 years or so older than I was. In view of my established record for flubbing the dub, I needed somebody older to look out for me and tell me no. And Ricky was just the girl who could do it. She had run Miles and Miles' house with serious little girl efficiency when she was less than 10. At 40, she would be just the same, only mellowed. I felt really warm and no longer lost in a strange land for the first time since I had wakened. Ricky was the answer to everything. Then, deep inside me, I heard a voice. Look, stupid, you can't marry Ricky, because a girl as sweet as she was going to be would now have been married for at least 20 years. She'll have 4 kids, maybe a son bigger than you are, and certainly a husband who won't be amused by you in the role of good old Uncle Danny. I listened, and my jaw sagged. Then I said feebly, all right, so I've missed the boat again. But I'm still going to look her up. They can't do more than shoot me. And after all, she's the only other person who really understood Pete. I turned another page, suddenly very glum at the thought of having lost both Ricky and Pete. After a while, I fell asleep over the paper and slept until Eager Beaver, or his twin, fetched lunch. While I was asleep, I dreamed that Ricky was holding me on her lap, saying, "It's all right, Danny. I found Pete, and now we're both here to stay. Isn't that so, Pete?"
Meow.
The added vocabularies were a cinch. I spent much more time on the historical summaries. Quite a lot can happen in 30 years, but why put it down when everybody else knows it better than I do? I wasn't surprised that the great Asia Republic was crowding us out of the South American trade. That had been in the cards since the Formosan Treaty. Nor was I surprised to find India more Balkanized than ever. The notion of England being a province of Canada stopped me for a moment. Which was the tail and which was the dog? I skipped over the panic of 87. Gold was a wonderful engineering material for some uses. I could not regard it as a tragedy to find that it was now cheap and no longer a basis for money, no matter how many people lost their shirts in the changeover. I stopped reading and thought about the things you could do with cheap gold, with its high density, good conductivity, extreme ductility, and stopped when I realized I would have to read the technical literature first. Shucks, in atomics alone it would be invaluable. The way the stuff could be worked, far better than any other metal, if you could use it in miniaturizing. Again I stopped, morally certain that Eager Beaver had had his head crammed full of gold. I would just have to get busy and find out what the boys had been doing in the small back rooms while I had been away. The Sawtell Sanctuary wasn't equipped to let me read up on engineering, so I told Doc Albrecht I was ready to check out. He shrugged, told me I was an idiot, and agreed. But I did stay one more night. I found that I was fagged just from lying back and watching words chase past in a book scanner. They brought me modern clothes right after breakfast the next morning, and I had to have help in dressing. They were not so odd in themselves, although I had never worn cerise trousers with bell-bottoms before, but I could not manage the fastenings without coaching. I suppose my grandfather might have had the same trouble with zippers if he had not been led into them gradually. It was the stick-tight closure seams, of course. I thought I was going to have to hire a little boy to help me go to the bathroom before I got it through my head that the pressure-sensitive adhesion was axially polarized. Then I almost lost my pants when I tried to ease the waistband. No one laughed at me. Dr. Albrecht asked, "What are you going to do?" "Me? First I'm going to get a map of the city, then I'm going to find a place to sleep. Then I'm going to do nothing but professional reading for quite a while, maybe a year. Doc, I'm an obsolete engineer. I don't aim to stay that way."
Well, good luck. Don't hesitate to call if I can help."
I stuck out my hand. "Thanks, Doc. You've been swell. Maybe I shouldn't mention this until I talk to the accounting office of my insurance company and see just how well off I am. But I don't intend to let it go with words. Thanks for the sort of thing you've done for me should be more substantial. Understand me?" He shook his head.
"I appreciate the thought, but my fees are covered by my contract with the sanctuary."
"But..."
"No, I can't take it. So please, let's not discuss it."
He shook hands and said,
"Goodbye. If you stay on this slide, it will take you to the main offices."
He hesitated.
"If you find things a bit tiring at first, you're entitled to 4 more days recuperation and reorientation here without additional charge under the custodial contract. It's paid for. Might as well use it. You can come and go as you like."
I grinned. "Thanks, Doc. But you can bet I won't be back, other than to say hello someday." I stepped off at the main office and told the receptionist there who I was. It handed me an envelope, which I saw was another phone message from Mrs. Schultz. I still had not called her because I did not know who she was, and the sanctuary did not permit visits or phone calls to a revivified client until he wanted to accept them. I simply glanced at it and tucked it in my blouse, while thinking that I might have made a mistake in making flexible Frank too flexible. Receptionists used to be pretty girls, not machines. The receptionist said,
"Step this way, please. Our treasurer would like to see you."
Well, I wanted to see him, too, so I stepped that way. I was wondering how much money I had made and was congratulating myself on having plunged in common stocks rather than playing it safe. No doubt my stocks had dropped in the panic of 87, but they ought to be back up now. In fact, I knew that at least two of them were worth a lot of dough now. I had been reading the financial section of the Times. I still had the paper with me, figuring I might want to look up some others. The treasurer was a human being, even though he looked like a treasurer. He gave me a quick handshake.
"How do you do, Mr. Davis? I'm Mr. Doughty. Sit down, please."
I said, "Howdy, Mr. Doughty. I probably don't need to take that much of your time. Just tell me this. Does my insurance company handle its settlements through your office, or should I go to their home offices?"
"Do, please, sit down. I have several things to explain to you."
So I sat. His office assistant, good old Frank again, fetched a file folder for him, and he said,
"These are your original contracts. Would you like to see them?"
I wanted very much to see them, as I had kept my fingers crossed ever since I was fully awake, wondering if Bell had figured out some way to bite the end off that certified check. A certified check is much harder to play hanky-panky with than is a personal check, but Bell was a clever gal. I was much relieved to see that she had left my commitments unchanged, except, of course, that the side contract for Pete was missing, and also the one concerning my hired girl stock. I supposed that she had just burned those to keep from raising questions. I examined with care the dozen or more places where she had changed Mutual Assurance Company to Master Insurance Company of California. The gal was a real artist, no question. I suppose a scientific criminologist armed with microscope and comparison stereo and chemical tests and so forth could have proved that each of those documents had been altered, but I could not. I wondered how she had coped with the closed endorsement on the back of the certified check, since certified checks are always on paper guaranteed non-erasable. Well, she probably had not used an eraser. What one person can dream up, another person can outsmart, and Bell was very smart. Mr. Doughty cleared his throat. I looked up. "Do we settle my account here?"
"Yes."
"Then I can put it in two words. How much?"
Mr. Davis, before we go into that question, I would like to invite your attention to one additional document, and to one circumstance. This is the contract between this sanctuary and Master Insurance Company of California for your hypothermia, custody, and revivification. You will note that the entire fee is paid in advance. This is both for our protection and for yours, since it guarantees your safe being while you are helpless. The funds, all such funds, are placed in escrow with the Superior Court Division handling chancery matters and are paid quarterly to us as earned.
Okay, sounds like a good arrangement.
It is. It protects the helpless. Now, you must understand clearly that this sanctuary is a separate corporation from your insurance company. The custodial contract with us was a contract entirely separate from the one for the management of your estate.
Mr. Doughty, what are you getting at?
Do you have any assets other than those you entrusted to Master Insurance Company?
I thought it over. I had owned a car once, but God alone knew what had become of it. I had closed out my checking account in Mojave early in the binge, and on that busy day when I ended up at Miles's place and in the soup, I had started with maybe $30 or $40 in cash. Books, clothes, slide rule. I had never been a pack rat, and that minor junk was gone anyhow. Not even a bus transfer, Mr. Doughty.
Then, I am very sorry to have to tell you this. You have no assets of any sort.
I held still while my head circled the field and came in for a crash landing.
What do you mean? Why, some of the stocks I invested in are in fine shape.
I know they are. It says so right here. I held up my breakfast copy of the Times. He shook his head.
I'm sorry, Mr. Davis, but you don't own any stocks. Master Insurance went broke.
I was glad he had made me sit down. I felt weak.
How did this happen? The panic? No, no, it was part of the collapse of the Mannix Group. But of course you don't know about that. It happened after the panic, and I suppose you could say that it started from the panic. But Master Insurance would not have gone under if it had not been systematically looted, gutted, milked is the vulgar word. If it had been an ordinary receivership, something at least would have been salvaged. But it was not. By the time it was discovered, there was nothing left of the company but a hollow shell, and the men who had done it were beyond extradition. Ah, if it is any consolation to you, it could not happen under our present laws. No, it was no consolation, and besides, I didn't believe it. My old man claimed that the more complicated the law, the more opportunity for scoundrels. But he also used to say that a wise man should be prepared to abandon his baggage at any time. I wondered how often I was going to have to do it to qualify as wise. Mr. Doughty, just out of curiosity, how did Mutual Assurance make out?
Mutual Assurance Company? A fine firm. Oh, they took their licking during the panic along with everybody else, but they weathered it. You have a policy with them, perhaps?
No. I did not offer explanation. There was no use. I couldn't look to Mutual. I had never executed my contract with them. I couldn't sue Master Insurance. There is no point in suing a bankrupt corpse. I could sue Bell and Miles if they were still around, but why be silly? No proof. None. Besides, I did not want to sue Bell. It would be better to tattoo her all over with null and void, using a dull needle. Then I'd take up the matter of what she had done to Pete. I hadn't figured out a punishment to suit the crime for that one yet. I suddenly remembered that it was the Mannix Group that Miles and Bell had been about to sell Hired Girl Inc. to when they had booted me out. Mr. Doughty, are you sure that the Mannix people haven't any assets? Don't they own Hired Girl?
Hired Girl? Do you mean the domestic auto appliance firm?
Yes, of course.
It hardly seems possible.
In fact, it is not possible, since the Mannix Empire as such no longer exists. Of course, I can't say that there never was any connection between Hired Girl Corporation and the Mannix people, but I don't believe it could have been much, if any, or I think I would have heard of it.
I dropped the matter. If Miles and Bell had been caught in the collapse of Mannix, that suited me fine. But on the other hand, if Mannix had owned and milked Hired Girl Inc., it would have hit Ricky as hard as it hit them. I didn't want Ricky hurt, no matter what the side issues were. I stood up.
Well, thanks for breaking it gently, Mr. Doughty. I'll be on my way.
Don't go yet. Mr. Davis, we of this institution feel a responsibility toward our people beyond the mere letter of the contract. You understand that yours is by no means the first case of this sort. Now our board of directors has placed a small discretionary fund at my disposal to ease such hardships. It...
No charity, Mr. Doughty. Thanks anyhow.
Not charity, Mr. Davis. A loan. A character loan, you might call it. Believe me, our losses have been negligible on such loans, and we don't want you to walk out of here with your pockets empty.
I thought that one over twice. I didn't even have the price of a haircut. On the other hand, borrowing money is like trying to swim with a brick in each hand, and a small loan is tougher to pay back than a million.
Mr. Doughty, I said slowly, Dr. Albrecht said that I was entitled to 4 more days of beans and bed here.
I believe that is right. I'd have to consult your card. Not that we throw people out even when their contract time is up if they are not ready.
I didn't suppose that you did. But what are the rates on that room I had, as hospital room and board?
Eh? But our rooms are not for rent in that way. We aren't a hospital. We simply maintain a recovery infirmary for our clients.
Yes, surely. But you must figure it, at least for cost accounting purposes.
Yes and no. The figures aren't allocated on that basis. The subheads are depreciation, overhead, operation, reserves, diet kitchen, personnel, and so forth. I suppose I could make an estimate.
Don't bother. What would equivalent room and board in a hospital come to?
That's a little out of my line. Still, well, You could call it about $100 per day, I suppose.
I had 4 days coming. Will you lend me $400? He did not answer, but spoke in a number code to his mechanical assistant. Then $8 $50 bills were being counted into my hand.
Thanks, I said sincerely as I tucked it away. I'll do my damnedest to see that this does not stay on the books too long.
6%? Or is money tight?
He shook his head. It's not a loan. Since you put it as you did, I canceled it against your unused time.
Huh?
Now see here, Mr. Dowdy, I didn't intend to twist your arm. Of course I'm going to...
Please. I told my assistant to enter the charge when I directed it to pay you. Do you want to give our auditors headaches all for a fiddling $400? I was prepared to loan you much more than that.
Well, I can't argue it now. Say, Mr. Dowdy, how much money is this? How are price levels now?
That is a complex question.
Just give me an idea. What does it cost to eat?
Food is quite reasonable. For $10, you can get a very satisfactory dinner, if you are careful to select moderate-priced restaurants.
I thanked him and left with a really warm feeling. Mr. Dowdy reminded me of a paymaster I used to have in the Army. Paymasters come in only 2 sizes. One sort shows you where the book says that you can't have what you've got coming to you. The second sort digs through the book until he finds a paragraph that lets you have what you need even if you don't rate it. Dowdy was the second sort. The sanctuary faced on the Wilshire Ways. There were benches in front of it, and bushes and flowers. I sat down on a bench to take stock and to decide whether to go east or west. I had kept a stiff lip with Mr. Dowdy, but, honestly, I was badly shaken, even though I had the price of a week's meals in my jeans. But the sun was warm and the drone of the ways was pleasant, and I was young, biologically at least, and I had 2 hands and my brain. Whistling "Hallelujah, I'm a Bum," I opened the Times to the Help Wanted columns. I resisted the impulse to look through Professional Engineers and turned at once to Unskilled. That classification was darned short. I almost couldn't find it.